It is 8:30, and we have with us once again in the studios Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning. We answered obediently.
Boy.
Good morning, teacher.
Gonna archive that and play it back on those times when you're not answering obediently. Well, speaking of
just when
teacher,
you need an ego boost, right?
Yes. Wanting to make you feel good. Setting you up for the rest of the show, actually.
So, well, speaking of teachers, it was hard to miss, at least in one of the newspapers this week, a big problem, actually, in the Seattle school districts, concern about trying to get the lead out there.
Yeah, we discovered why all of our kids have attention deficit disorder. Report coming out that the Seattle schools have a severe problem with lead in the drinking water, and in particular some of the older schools in the district and some of the elementary schools where kids are at a fairly critical developmental age.
Yeah, and it was pretty amazing, too, that it was in the PI but not in the Times. It was a big banner headline in the Seattle PI, and the Times pretty much ignored it. What's also striking about this, too, is what the school district did when they found out that there might be a lead problem in the schools. Instead of trying to take some steps to correct the problem, they simply decided to expand testing and see, well, oh gosh, let's hope it goes away and see if is it really as big a problem as we think.
Yeah, maybe if we have a larger sample size and we discover more kids that have these problems, then maybe we'll take some action. So
So
I think it really is important, particularly if you're a parent who has you know, kids that are in any of the affected schools or who might have symptoms that the symptoms of lead poisoning really do mirror attention deficit disorder. It's fairly similar. Contact the school district, contact the school board, ask them to take action on this. Don't let them get away with just continuing to study the problem and study it and study it and hope it goes away and hope the public attention goes away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to wonder with all this recent boom over the last few years of, you know, attention deficit disorder across the country and all the drugs that the prescription companies have been shelling out for tune of billions of dollars, if in fact what is happening at the Seattle School District isn't happening at school districts across the country.
Yeah, well, it's more profitable to sell drugs than it is to get the lead out of the drinking water in school districts across the country.
Right, so hopefully there will be an investigation into, who dropped the ball on this and more than that, fixing the pipes ASAP. So
yep.
And finding the money, that might be the biggest challenge.
Yeah, and that as is always the challenge for the schools.
Sure. All right, well, moving along, this week was a notable one for court decisions.
Yeah, we started getting the traditional June and early July flurry of court rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court, and one of them in particular was really quite interesting. That was the one that was really a pretty stunning setback for the administration, a sweeping decision by the majority of court rulings, and it was 6-3 in the major case out of the three of them they ruled on, saying that the whole administration, I don't know what the best word to describe it is, but the structure upon which they hung the idea of enemy combatants and people being unable to have access to lawyers or due process of any kind, that was completely unconstitutional. And this affects the detainees at Guantanamo. It affects the cases of Jose Padilla, the plaintiff in this case, Amir Hamdi, the U.S. citizen who was arrested in Afghanistan fighting with the Taliban. His case, of course, goes back to court, and his family had filed on his behalf because he didn't have access to counsel. So you have these court rulings. You also had a lower court ruling earlier in the week with the Federal Communications Commission that was a significant setback, and we had a lot of people in this city as well as several others who attended an FCC town hall hearing, basically, that was held in Seattle about a year and a half ago as part of the run-up to the FCC ownership regulations. Well, that was held by it wasn't an actual true public hearing by the FCC. It was held by the two Democratic senators out of the five on the commission, and the three Republican eventually carried the day with with these ownership limits that significantly deregulated ownership regulations in terms of the ability of large corporations to own a higher percentage of the country's market share. The federal court said basically the FCC had to have incorporate public testimony and public concerns into its rulemaking, and sent it back to the FCC and said, you know, this kind of wanton deregulation without concern for public considerations is unconstitutional.
Now, I had a little bit of a different take on the Supreme Court rulings regarding the detainees, and I just want to talk about that for a minute.
Sure.
In the one case, in the case of Hamdi, the U.S. citizen of Arabic descent who was captured in Afghanistan, what the court ruled was that the U.S. government could use the status of illegal combatant, and they could detain a person indefinitely.
Yes, that's correct.
So they did rule that.
But they did have to have access to the judicial system.
That's what I want to talk about. Basically, what they're setting up is a situation where he can be detained forever. He has no resources because it's 3 years after he was caught in Afghanistan. He'd probably have almost no ability to find any witnesses who could testify that he wasn't a combatant, that he was perhaps an aid worker, or he was perhaps visiting relatives or sightseeing or whatever, or that he was perhaps had joined the Taliban long before the war. What they've set up is a situation where the guy is guilty until he can prove that he's innocent. So the burden is on him to prove that the U.S.
Why do you say that?
Because he's going to be held indefinitely. He can challenge his detention in court, but he has to prove his innocence in order to be released. That's what they've set up. So now what you saw in the decision is a really astonishing alliance between the court's most conservative judge, Souter,
and very true.
John Paul Stevens, the most liberal judge on the court, saying, look, this is screwed up. This decision is screwed up.
Yeah, and Scalia said the same thing.
Yeah.
That it was screwed up.
No, he said it for a different reason. These guys said this is screwed up because what you should be doing is the guy, you should be adhering to innocent until proven guilty. The guy should be released. And then you should file charges against him if he's done anything wrong. That's the way our justice system is supposed to work. And this decision did not adhere to that. So in a way, that this court decision in the Hamdi case in particular is a bad one. Now, regarding the detainees at Guantanamo, which is another one of the cases, the Padilla case is also screwed up in another way. They threw it back to a different court, which means now, well, the U.S. can continue to move him from holding cell to holding cell all
and
over the country.
And jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Yeah, and his case will be continued to be thrown out and thrown out and thrown out and thrown out because it's not filed in the proper jurisdiction. That's messed up. That the Padilla case, that decision was very bad. Now, in the third case of the Guantanamo detainees, they basically did the same thing. They said these guys can be held indefinitely as illegal combatants, but they have access to the U.S. courts to challenge their detention, which, again, is the same thing. They're guilty until proven innocent, essentially.
I don't see where you're getting the guilty until proven innocent.
They're guilty because they can be detained forever, and they
But part of the due process is that they have to have access to courts within a certain amount of time.
Right, and it's been 3 years.
I understand that.
And it's going to be another 3 years at least until they can bring up a case before the Supreme Court and get a decision releasing some of these guys. Now, the U.S. government was so sure it was going to win its case that they did not make any provisions for if they lost even a small part of it. So they could take months to years to decide what is the adequate court to try these guys. And these guys cannot bring... They won't have access to witnesses to testify for them. What kind of evidence can they use? The U.S. controls their access to lawyers. It could take another 3 years for them to bring a case right up to the Supreme Court to say, you got to give these guys you know, access to their lawyers without surveillance, et cetera.
There's two different things here that I think you're conflating. One is the precedent that these cases set for future detainees, and the other is how the U.S. will respond to these actual cases that have already been happening, that are already 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
That in those cases the due process has already been violated in a pretty fundamental and pretty severe way. In future cases where presumably they'll have access to the courts in a timely manner, where they'll have more of a chance to prove their innocence. I agree that guilty until proven innocent is a bad standard if that's what it is. But at the same time, the timeliness issue isn't going to be as much of an issue in future cases as it will be for the cases that have already happened.
I don't know that's true, because it's been 3 years, and it could be another 3 years before these guys actually get a chance to have...
You're talking about these cases right now. I'm talking about future cases that this court sets a precedent for.
Well, yeah, precedence is important, but I think what we have to look at is the cases in front of us and the guys who are in detention now and what their rights are versus what their rights were. Now, sure, it was bad that they were held without any access to the courts. They disappeared into Guantanamo with no ability to contact relatives or friends or lawyers or the media or anybody. That's bad. That's very bad. It's true. But this is not a whole lot better. Just because they have lawyers now who can act on their behalf, and because they can file cases in the court, doesn't mean that they will necessarily be able to carry those through, or that they will have the ability to produce evidence to get them released. And in the fact that they are not going to be filed against them, the way our justice system works is when you're arrested and held in jail, they have to file charges or they have to let you go. You can only stay for so long. That's not the case here, and that is a violation of our
understand that,
justice
but,
system.
But they could also, in these guys' cases, file charge and then see these guys are an imminent threat. They cannot be released. There's no guarantee that they would be released anyway. There's no guarantee they would have access.
Oh, no, that's true.
They would have to file those charges, and they would have to have something
that could be addressed.
I understand that.
Which is not the case here.
I understand that. At the same time, you know, there's a number of elements of whether they would eventually be let free or not, which would be stacked against them regardless, even if they had perfect access to the courts, the same as any other defendants in this country who have the rights stacked against them by our system.
Yeah, the lawyers.
That's very true. But
let me interrupt here because this can go on forever.
Oh yeah,
it's true.
The lawyers that they're supplied with, are those supplied by the U.S. government, or do they have to dig up their own lawyers?
Now, the ones that the U.S. administration, that the Bush administration wants to try before a military tribunal, get a lawyer appointed to them. Now, in the case of one of those guys, one of those lawyers has been appointed for one of the detainees. He has pretty much come out and said he thinks the system is screwed up and stacked against his client. So that's one of the ways that this Supreme Court decision has really been a problem, because it has said that it's all right for the Bush administration to try these guys in a military tribunal is okay because the status of illegal combatant is okay and the indefinite detention is okay. So in a way, it is a victory. They haven't completely disappeared into Guantanamo, and Jav might think that it's more of a victory than I think it is, but in another way, I think it is seriously screwed up.
Yeah, and I agree that it's not ideal by any stretch of the imagination.
All right, well, let's move along. Hamid Karzai, he's hoping for elections sooner than we'd like to give them to him.
Yeah, and some of us are hoping that he would disappear into the woodwork. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, it's been the better part of 3 years since the Taliban have been driven out of power.
Speaking of three years.
In Afghanistan. And Hamid Karzai was appointed as the interim president. And 3 years of an interim presidency, supposedly there were supposed to be elections held in June of this year. Well, June has come and gone. The elections were postponed to September because election, UN election officials said they had only registered about 5 to 10% of the eligible voters in Afghanistan because the security situation is so bad that aid workers cannot make it to most of the various regions, outlying regions outside of the capital, without coming under attack by militia members or the Taliban, the resurgent Taliban, etc. And now, for elections to happen in September, they would have had to have set a date by June 30th for the elections to happen sometime by September 30th. And the Afghan government did not do that because, of course, they have no contact with most of the country. They're stuck inside the capital of Kabul, and there is no way that they can, they know that there is no way that they can organize elections. So Hamid Karzai went to NATO and he said, please, please give us troops so that we can get our election workers out to the countryside just to register people. Please send us troops.
These aren't even the elections. This is just the registration for the elections.
Yeah, just getting people to register for the elections. Now, they have to set a date for elections in order for them to happen this year. The date has to be set sometime before the end of October, which is when the snows set in and much of the country becomes completely inaccessible until next year, until next spring. And if they don't set an election date in the next month, then NATO doesn't send them any troops to guard some of these election workers, some of whom have been killed in the last few weeks in Afghanistan, then the elections are not going to happen there this year.
Now, why is it NATO rather than the UN?
Well, it's NATO because NATO has pretty much taken control of the peacekeeping force that is pretty much confined. It is more or less confined to Kabul, the capital city. And so since NATO is in control of that force, Karzai has gone to NATO and said, please, can you move your troops outside of the capital so that we can have some security in the countryside? Or can you send us more troops or send us some helicopters or something, you know? And NATO has said, sorry, we don't have the resources to do that. And most particularly, the U.S. should be spearheading that effort. But as we all know, U.S. troops are tied up elsewhere.
All right. Moving along, Counterspin, they were talking about Sudan and the fact that the corporate press seems to have caught up, that there was a story there, is a story there.
Yeah, there was a column by, I believe it was Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times about a week ago Thursday that described the situation in the Western Sudan, and it was suddenly as though this became this large urgent problem, and it is an urgent problem. It's a tremendously urgent problem, but it has been for the last 2 years in particular, and in some ways for the last decade, the situation in the Sudan. And the United States in particular has really looked the other way in this situation. It's been very typical, I think, of crises in Africa in general, both the United States response and the media response, that it's very, very difficult to get attention to what happens in sub-Saharan Africa. And it really is a case where lives there don't seem to register as being as important as lives in the rest of the world. Certainly, as important as lives in the U.S., because you've got literally several million people in the Sudan that whose lives are endangered in the situation now, and the United States does not have the resources at the present to commit because. They're so tied up in particularly in Iraq and Afghanistan that they don't have the ability to respond as they did, for example, in Somalia or Ethiopia in past years.
All right, well, that leaves us with the one thing left, and that's this week in Iraq.
Well, the topic this week is the finances in Iraq. And there were some reports that were issued this week. On Monday, the same day that the early handover happened, the Christian Aid Group, a group of folks, an NGO in Britain, released a report that the Coalition Provisional Authority had delayed doing an audit of how it's been spending Iraqis' oil money. Now the CPA was required by the UN Resolution 1483, which was passed in May 2003, that it should have an independent outside group or agency audit its books for how it spent Iraq's oil money. Now the Coalition Provisional Authority delayed and delayed and delayed appointing an auditor and didn't get around to it until April of this year, 2 months before they were getting ready to dissolve the Coalition Provisional Authority itself, and the auditor hasn't had time to release its report. So Christian Aid released this report and said, look, there's $20 billion of Iraq's own money that the coalition has spent, and they haven't told anybody what it's gone for, which companies have been paid for what, and what projects they were working on.
Yeah, that's billion with a B.
Yeah, 20. That's billion. $20 billion, and that's Iraq's own money. Now, on Tuesday, the day after the handover happened and the coalition dissolved itself, the coalition's own inspector general basically said, okay, this is what I've been working on. Here are three audits that aren't complete, but here they are. You know, you might as well see them since the Coalition Provisional Authority doesn't exist anymore. And those three audits really heavily criticized the coalition's financial controls, called them chaotic. For example, there was no system of tracking how many employees the Coalition Provisional Authority even had, so there must not have been any formal payroll system. Kind of conjures up a vision of guys running around with suitcases full of cash saying, have you been paid yet? Have you been paid yet? How much do we pay you? Now, the Coalition Provisional Authority even failed to coordinate spending to prevent the duplication of projects. So here's the Coalition Provisional Authority's own inspector general saying he thinks that they just threw money at projects, and then if those guys wanted more and came back and wanted more money, they gave them more money, and they duplicated some of their expenses. Now, it's pretty convenient that this came out just the day after the Coalition Provisional Authority ceased to exist. But even more convenient, and disgustingly so, is that yesterday, on the Friday before the July 4th weekend, the White House Office of Management and Budget released a report. It was their quarterly report on how the reconstruction spending in Iraq was going. Now, this was a report on the U.S. taxpayer money, that 18-some billion dollars that Congress had approved last year to be spent on reconstruction.
Yeah, and if you want to talk about the White House proclivity for releasing bad information on the Friday before a weekend, particularly a holiday weekend when the news cycle is at its lowest, when people are least likely to be paying attention, this is a perfect example.
Yeah, this is a perfect example. Now, of the 18-plus billion dollars allocated for Iraq reconstruction, $10 billion were supposed to have been spent by now. $10 billion was supposed to be spent by now, but only a measly $366 million has been spent as of June 22nd. Now, I've got the little chart here
that
has the numbers.
That's about one out of every $30, something like that?
Something like that, yeah. Now, I've got the little chart here. What's been spent is $194 million for security and law enforcement. Okay, so that's training Iraqi police and Iraqi troops. So only $194 million has been spent for that.
To create an entire national system.
Right. And they've spent $22 million on justice, public safety, infrastructure, and civil society. So that's basically setting up the court system. Probably most of that's being spent for Saddam Hussein's trial. Now, for the electrical sector, only $109 billion has been spent. $81 million on generation and $28 million on transmission, and rest of the projects have not gotten funded at all. For the oil infrastructure, only $12 million has been spent. Get this, for water resources and sanitation, $0. For education, or actually for healthcare, $0. Zero has been spent on hospitals and maternity clinics, etc. Zero has been spent. For roads, bridges, and construction for their transportation system, again, zero. Zero has been spent. And so, again, it only totals up to $366 million. It is shocking. But what's even more shocking is when you look at the details of the report, you see on page after page and in section after section the reason why the money hasn't been spent. They continually blame it on the security situation. Reconstruction has come to a complete halt. So you might question this. These reports coming out in the same week. Gosh, if only $366 million of U.S. taxpayer money has been spent because reconstruction has come to a halt, what the heck have they been spending $20 billion of Iraqi oil money on? It's not for reconstruction, right? It's got to be for something else. And my guess would be it would mostly be for U.S. troops and for some of these battles against the al-Sadr's militia and
for security,
Fallujah. So yeah. Basically for security. Now, I also want to talk a little bit about that too, because one of the things that in Iraq that is working, that has been getting funding, is the Iraqi Ministry of the Interior. Now, the Ministry of the Interior is what's supposed to control Iraq's security forces. And this week, The Guardian of London reported that U.S. troops invaded an Iraqi Ministry of the Interior building because Iraqi police were beating and torturing detainees. Now, when they invaded the building, U.S. troops asked these guys, well, why are you beating these people? And here's what one of the guards, the Iraqi guards, said. Quote, "The American asked me why we had beaten the prisoners. I said we beat the prisoners because they were all bad people. But I told them we didn't strip them naked, photograph them, or bleep them like you did." Now, for that word bleep, you can substitute a four-letter word that you know of that means sex. So let me just read that last part again. "I told them we didn't strip them naked, photograph them, or bleep them like you did." So that tells you a little bit about the kind of precedent U.S. troops have set in Iraq right now. So that's what I want to leave you with for this week in Iraq.
All right. And very quickly, because in a minute, there was a study done by the New England Journal of Medicine that came out.
Yeah, and it showed that levels of post-traumatic stress disorder in troops returning from Iraq are just about the same as they were for troops returning from Vietnam. And it's early days yet. PTSD takes a while to manifest in people. You don't come down with it immediately after you've killed an Iraqi civilian or
so they're already
seen,
that high. So they're
or
likely
seen your
to
buddies
be higher.
Die. It's likely to be higher than what it was in Vietnam at this when you see these rates from troops just returning from the battlefield.
Right.
And what was really interesting about that is that 14% of the troops returning said, of Army troops returning said that they had been responsible for killing an Iraqi civilian. And 28% of the Marines returning said that they were responsible for the death of at least one Iraqi civilian. So if you look at the total number of U.S. troops that have cycled through the country, that means the number of dead Iraqi civilians has got to be a lot higher than 11,000, which is the conservative estimate. It's probably up around 30,000 to 50,000 or more.
Well, and as Dr. Evan Kanner told us here a couple weeks back on Community Forum, his analysis, well, it's not just his, is that the Iraqi civilians have a rate of 95% for PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, and again, not just killed, but wounded also, because the hospital system is in such disarray, and because zero U.S. taxpayer dollars have been spent on the hospital system.
Right. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, with that, we are out of time. Talking once again, as we do every week, with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, and you guys are still running your fun drive?
Oh, yeah.
We are still.
We got 2 weeks left, so you only have to hear this for two more weeks. You still have the opportunity.
Something we haven't mentioned on the radio, if folks donate $300 or more, you get to go out to dinner with me and Job.
You get to hear us squabble.
You get to hear us fight over topics over the dinner table.
And if you think you can actually hold down your food while that's happening.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's
we are happy to do that. $300 or more, and we'll take you out to dinner in a nice restaurant, and you can ask us, you can pick our brains about whatever topics you like, and then you might be horrified by the results, but there you go. It is an opportunity.
Uh-huh. So, and if you are interested in donating, there's a little button on our website for PayPal. You can do it by credit card that way, or you can send us a check to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145.
Yeah, and the website is www.eatthestate.org. It's for the newspaper. The money goes mostly for printing and postage. It comes out every other week, and it's a largely volunteer effort, and you get news and information like this locally and globally. And very few communities have newspapers like this, and it's very much a shoestring operation. So that's why we need your help. That's why we're asking for it.
That's right. Buy those shoestrings.